rolls around, you finally lay your burden down. Close up your books, get out of your seat. Down the halls and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend. Right to the juke, John, you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot.
You're listening to Health Center in the Catskills on WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, Health Center in the Catskills. The time is 2:29, almost 2:30. Well, to those of us in public health, science, and healthcare, the Trump administration's massive and indiscriminate cuts in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, the National Institutes of Health, and other parts of Health and Human Services, and the suspension of federal scientific review panels, removal of publicly available data from federal health-related websites, and other actions that they are taking really can be viewed as endangering the public's health in the short term, as well as certainly in the long term. But what does the public think of these significant changes? Are they even aware of them? Well, Dr. Rebecca Nagler is an associate professor at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota, who conducted a survey that sought to answer these questions. The results are published by the Milbank Memorial Fund on April, were published by the Milbank Memorial Fund on April 25th. I want to welcome Dr. Rebecca Nagler to Health Center in the Catskills. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks, Diana. Good to be here.
So talk a little bit about why you did this study.
Yeah, I think your introduction sort of read our minds a little bit. I mean, I think what my team and I were noticing here in Minnesota certainly was what any, you know, public health researchers, practitioners, those in the scientific community more broadly were noticing since the inauguration in January, right? Those sort of sweeping changes that were happening at federal health and science agencies, including the ones you listed, NIH, CDC, NSF, most recently, too, and earlier on, USAID as well, of course. And so, you know, those of us who were sort of steeped in this world were very aware of how sweeping these changes were, how indiscriminate, as you said, some of the slashing and burning was, and a lot of real concern. But we were not sure the extent to which this was salient only for those of us who are really a part of this world on a daily basis. And so the goal here was really to tap into sort of public awareness and perception.
So tell us who you surveyed and how.
Right. Yeah. So we worked with NORC at the University of Chicago.
Through the NORC being?
It's a public opinion research outfit out of the University of Chicago.
Thank you.
That's been operating for a really long time. They maintain what's called the Amerispeak panel, which has upwards of nearly, I think now, 60,000 U.S. adults in its panel. It is nationally representative. It's one of the best around. And they have an omnibus survey, which is essentially a crowdsourced survey that is available to researchers, to organizations, news organizations, lots, you know, anyone who wants to sort of add questions to this survey that they will field twice a month on average with about 1,000 participants, members of their panel. You don't have to pay for basically a whole survey instrument. You're essentially adding a subset of questions that then goes out, and you get these really high quality data for what is effectively a very cost effective price tag, right, in the land of research. Mm-hmm. So we've worked with them before. Our team had published a few papers during COVID, having worked with the omnibus. And so I guess the important thing to know is this is a nationally representative sample of U.S. adults.
And give us the time frame, because, you know, when you did the survey, some egregious cuts had not yet happened.
Yeah, that's right. So we fielded, this was the omnibus that was in the field from March 20th to 24th. And so that followed Certainly a lot of changes and events, including a lot of the communications pause that affected HHS, the proposal to cap indirects at 15% for those NIH sort of overhead costs to universities, the early attacks, if you will, on Columbia, and sort of the halting of federal support for them. So the main event, I would say, that followed the fielding was the April 1st 10,000 folks cut from laid off from HHS.
So you first looked at how aware people were of some of these changes. Tell us what you found in terms of that awareness.
Yeah, I would say we asked about eight specific changes, and you know, there we could have asked about more. That was the set that we went with based on the media and public discourse at the time, what seemed to be really prevalent enough in media coverage that people would have had an opportunity to be aware if they were engaged with the information at all. And I would say overall we found a mix in level, right? There were some issues, some changes for which there was considerable awareness. The highest awareness overall we saw was basically for firing of federal scientists and health workers, right? That was number one. And again, this predates that April 1st massive cut from HHS staff. So, and then from there, we also saw a substantial number saying that they had heard about federal cuts to health research and treatment abroad. So those USAID cuts, to the NIH indirect cuts, costs, and then the some canceling of specific research grants. Whereas we saw much less awareness on balance, fewer than half, or right around half, saying that they were aware of canceled meetings around the ACIP, the vaccine meetings, suspended scientific peer review, and removals of public data from federal websites. So a mix in levels of awareness overall.
One of the things that was most fascinating to me, though, was the differences of in awareness between Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, that sort of reinforced that we're getting our news sources from different news from different sources. Tell us about some of these differences. Some of them were quite striking.
Yeah, I agree with you, Diana. You know, and this is nothing new, right? Those of us who are working in public health and communication research have seen partisan patterning with awareness data, perceptions data, and message effects experiments, right? This is what we are seeing as sort of polarized responses to health and science information. And part of it, you're right, has likely to do with the fact that the news sources that people attend to do vary across partisan lines, and the coverage within those news organizations varies, right, in terms of what gets top billing. But there's other reasons, too, things like response bias, different levels of attentiveness to health and science issues generally can shape some of this. But the important point, I think, is that we are not all necessarily getting, you know, seeing the same things and attending to the same information, right? So in some cases where there was really much, much higher levels of awareness among Democrats than their independent and Republican counterparts. That said, there were still issues where you still had 60-70% of independents and Republicans saying that they had heard something about some of these issues. So it's not to suggest that awareness is non-existent in those groups. That's not the case.
Yeah. Now, you also asked about what people saw as the impact of some of these cuts and changes on people. And tell us about that, the findings there.
Yeah, so we had focused specifically on, I guess you could say, three of those eight changes that really centered on NIH research cuts, right? And so we sort of asked specifically about whether participants thought that the proposed cuts to NIH research budgets and funding would have a set of impacts. How likely, how much did they agree or disagree that funding cuts to NIH research grants would lead to a host of different outcomes? And we didn't describe those outcomes as negative or positive in the survey itself, but on the back end, we're able to sort of apply those labels, if you will. And we wound up asking essentially about what could be considered five negative impacts of cuts, both in terms of economic and patient care outcomes, and three positive impacts. And again, these were really drawn from media and public discourse. And overall, we saw that there was more agreement, I would say, that their impacts would be negative, right? With roughly 50% of participants saying that, yeah, they agreed that these, you know, this was going to lead to delays in development of new medical treatments, fewer clinical trials for cancer patients, the sort of recognition that those in public health and science would hope that people would have, compared to roughly 25% saying that they thought there would be positive impacts in the form of greater efficiencies or more money available to spend on patient care. The only other thing I would be sure to note, though, is that there were large numbers of people who said they really, basically the equivalent of they didn't know, right? Mm-hmm. They neither agreed nor disagreed with what the outcomes would be. And part of that is because we just don't know exactly what the outcomes will ultimately be, but it could also reflect some degree of uncertainty and unfamiliarity on people's part.
So what are the implications of this? What are the takeaways for you on this survey?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple the first is perhaps, again, to recognize that changes are only continuing, right? So those April 1st firings, the number of people who are likely to recognize, for example, the federal layoffs has probably increased. The other thing we haven't talked about is just how many people have been personally affected by these firings, right? It was nearly 1 in 5 participants in our survey, so that they had either personally, you know, because of themselves or someone they know well, been affected by these layoffs at the federal level. And that number is only going to increase, right? And what's important about that, too, is it can shape, just like partisans can shape what you're aware of and how you perceive, so too can your personal experience. And so I think we have to really watch for that moving forward as the impact of these changes is felt further and further and farther, you know, by more and more people in our country. The other thing I think another important point I would make is that awareness is not equivalent to understanding, right? Mm-hmm. We were getting this sort of gestalt view on, like, have you heard anything about this? But just because you've heard about it doesn't mean you understand what it means, mm-hmm. right? And so I think there's a responsibility, really a shared responsibility for all of us who are in this space to be able to share stories about why this matters, right? Yeah. You know, what the implications are when you have cuts at academic institutions and other research institutions in the form of federal grants, how that really interrupts science in a way that can have extremely important implications for patient care across not just things like cancer, but Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, and so on and so forth, that to sort of connect that thread and provide, where we can, really a human narrative behind the impact of some of these changes.
And to both of those points that you've made, I think the adage of the personal is political really holds forth, that to really help people to understand the importance and to be ready to take action, even that the importance of what's going on when it starts to affect them, their family, their friends, maybe their community, maybe their neighbors, then they realize this is something I need to pay attention to. And your work has really looked at the routine exposure, the effects of routine exposure to health information in the media and around particularly conflicting and sometimes controversial health information. Tell us about the lessons that you have learned even before the survey, but with the survey too, about helping the public. How do we help the public to embrace evidence and to be able to think about the value of science?
Yeah, it's such a multifaceted issue. But I think one thing that our team has focused a lot on in recent years is trying to think about ways of reminding people how science works, and the fact that it is evolving, that it is, things are supposed to change, right? That is a feature, not a flaw. So part of what we've tried to do, for example, is, like, if in the context of health communication campaigns and media campaigns around, you know, health issues, if we sort of take an opportunity to remind people, like, hey, you might have heard this before, and now we're telling you that something has changed here, that's okay. Here's why the evidence, you know, we learned more, and you know, this is how this happened, to kind of remind people about that iterative process that is really what science is all about, that we have some indication that can really help people to withstand the negative effects of exposure to conflicting science or what is perceived to be ever-changing guidance. We obviously saw a lot of that with COVID,
yeah.
And our team kind of spent some time really documenting that. And so I think messaging about the scientific process, reminding people what science is and how it works, can help. But there's so much more to it now, right? I mean, because if you think about these data, I think, you know, if there's a lot going on, right? And if someone wasn't aware of some of these issues, it's not an indictment. I mean, there's a lot to pay attention to right now.
Yes.
And, you know, and these data say nothing about whether someone's paying attention to what's happening with immigration, to what's happening with the economy, to what's happening with, right? So part of it is that we just have finite information processing capacity. And so figuring out ways to invite people to engage with science, to think hard about evidence, but also recognize that they're stretched in every sense.
Yeah. I actually was speaking on a webinar, I think it was the end of last week, and it was to a nursing group, and I was asked in the Q&A what I thought about, and I did talk about a little bit about some of the changes that are going on at the federal level and people being mindful and paying attention to those. And I got a question about, did I think that maybe since there were likely to be cuts and had already been some cuts in funding for nursing education, that it's a time for us to be looking at how to move forward on the nursing workforce issues through the private sector. And I have to say, I felt like I can't even, and I said, I can't even focus on that question, because I feel like right now, what's at the threats to democracy, the threats to human rights, the threats to freedom of speech, the threats to our institution outweigh that very focused self-interest concern right now. There needs to be a larger picture. So I felt overwhelmed. I feel overwhelmed by all of the information. So I know there are people who do tune out because there's so much information, but I am a proponent that we can't tune out. So that's some of my perspective on this. But I want to talk a little bit about the importance of stories. So one of the things that I think is really important in this time is to hear from people who are being affected, whether positively or negatively, by the changes that are going on at the federal level and how that's impacting the state and the local level and people directly. There was another webinar I was on where they were, or maybe it wasn't, maybe it was a news program. I think it was a news program. And they had three people who were disabled talking about what impact cuts in Medicaid would have on their lives. And I thought it was very powerful. Talk to us about the role of storytelling and narratives in all of this.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really robust literature around narrative persuasion and the ways in which it is different than other forms of communication, especially media-based communication, where we are less likely to counter-argue something when it's when we have the option to sort of be transported into this narrative world of storytelling and kind of connect with the characters, the leads, right? And this has certainly, you know, been the case when we think about entertainment narratives and health information that gets embedded in entertainment programs, right? But it also applies to storytelling that can happen in the form of, you know, a scientist sharing about their grant that's been terminated and the science that will never happen as a result of that and what they were studying and why that matters and the community organizations who they were working with who now will not be able to have the resources to continue the work they were doing, right? It invites people to sort of not be as, we're less likely, our resistance mechanisms don't kick in as aggressively as they can with other forms of more expository communication. And so we're able to be a little bit more open to the possibility that what we're hearing could maybe take us in a different direction in our thinking. And so I think there is something to that right now. To your point earlier, Diana, there's no question, as someone who sits in the School of Journalism, I can tell you news avoidance is a trend that colleagues of mine here at Minnesota have studied for a while. It is absolutely a phenomenon that we're seeing, and for good reason. I get it. But in a time where people are systematically turning away from news and information for self-protective reasons, how can we, through our social networks, through conversations with people in our community, through, you know, if you're an organization, a local or state health department, how can you be talking with people in your community, your constituents, you know, about what's happening in a way that still invites them into that conversation without adding to that feeling of overwhelm?
And I want to underscore what you're saying, because this morning I went on to actually the Margaville Community Chat, and there was a whole somewhat heated discussion, particularly with one member of the community. And there is a Francis Thomas, who I do not know, I don't think, but who actually shared, instead of just attacking the person, explained why this change, this impact, was going to affect people and people in general. And it was about, somebody posted something about a rally that's going to happen in Delhi, or a demonstration on Saturday at 10 o'clock in the morning in Delhi, it's a May Day and demonstration. It's also a hands-off demonstration. Some other groups are coming together. And so there were a lot of comments about this, and the one person who really objected to it got lots of responses from the community, but Mr. Thomas's responses really stood out in terms of talking about what impact these cuts are going to have on our community. For example, we have a high rate of poverty in our county. We have kids, 30-40% of the kids in this county live in poverty. And Head Start becomes very important. And as I'm sure you know, the Head Start programs, there is so much evidence about the value of Head Start programs for the success of children in school and helping them to get out of poverty in the long term. And indeed, the Head Start programs are on the chopping block. It's really stunning to think that the science is being disregarded by those who are making the cuts. So Mr. Thomas goes through and just describes what the various cuts, what impact it's going to have on our community, our children, our families. And I found it very powerful, and much more powerful than simply just attacking the person who objected to the demonstrations.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's an empathy that we can bring to these conversations as well, right? To understand, I mean, I think there's an appreciation we have to have for why people might come to these conversations with a certain set of beliefs and a certain set of priors, and then to be open to the possibility that maybe there's another way of thinking about these issues.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Rebecca Nagler, an associate professor at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota, thank you so much for coming on to Health Cetera today, to Health Cetera and the Catskills, to talk about this survey. And for people who would like to get more information about this work, how can they do so?
Oh, yeah, sure. So you're welcome to email me. You can find my, if you put my name into Google, it'll come right up.
Spell your name, though.
Yeah, okay, so it is spelled a little funny. It's Rebecca, R-E-B-E-K-A-H. Last name is Nagler, N-A-G-L-E-R. So I'm happy to sort of send you the link, but also if you want to just go to the Milbank Quarterly site, the opinion pieces of which this is one are publicly available.
Yes, so just Google Milbank Memorial Fund or Milbank Quarterly, and public survey will published April 25th will get you there as well. But otherwise, her name is Dr. Rebecca, R-E-B-E-K-A-H, Nagler, N-A-G-L-E-R. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for coming on today.
Thanks, Diana. It was a pleasure. Take care.